Good evening. Normally when I say it gives me great pleasure to speak, I don't really mean it, but I actually mean it. But I find it a pleasure because it's I'm introducing David Simon. And David did his PhD here, getting his PhD in 2019. Before that, he had studied first at University of Michigan and did an LLB at Chicago Kent.
A JD.
JD, sorry. Oops. Then an LLM at Harvard, and then finally came in PhD. And subsequently, he's had jobs at Kansas and at the Petrie Flom Center in Harvard and at Georgetown, and is now associate professor at Northeastern.
Yeah.
I was confused, Northeastern and
Northeastern. It was George Washington, but, well, you know, it's okay.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
You upgraded me.
Or did I? Yeah. George, what did I say? American?
I don't remember. Not sure.
So that's David's amazing career. And he now works mainly in medical product viability and has done quite a lot on drug patenting. But when he was here, he came with this idea. I had no influence over him while he was here, but he was a joy to work with. He came to work on moral rights and, in particular, the relationship between moral rights and psychological theory or current understandings of psychology. And it's from that work that he's going to present tonight's presentation. Looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for coming. That was a very kind introduction. I'll say my experience could have been a lot worse if I had a different supervisor. So I felt very, very lucky at why I was my supervisor. And it was a large reason why I finished my PhD. And this paper is actually almost 20 years old, so I started working on it almost 20 years ago, and still I'm not sure if I've got it right, but the paper is about copyright, and in particular, it's about moral rights. So you have two sets of rights in copyright. You have the economic rights. Those are supposed to enable the author to recoup their investment and help disseminate the work. And then you have the personal or the non-economic rights, the moral rights, and those are not supposed to compensate the author for any of the work that they've done, but they're supposed to serve some other purpose. And so this paper is sort of about what is that other purpose, and I'll tell you more about that in a second. But here are some examples from cases where moral rights were at issue. So we have Snow versus the Eden Center. This was a Canadian artist who was commissioned to produce this installation and of geese at a shopping center, and the owner of the shopping center wanted to, I think, hang some ribbons during Christmas time and objected. He said, no, you know, that offends my moral rights. That violates my moral rights. The other two cases that are pictured here involve art installations. One took place in Massachusetts. It was an art installation, outdoor art installation. The other was an indoor art installation, but it was kind of the same thing. They wanted to move things around or take things away. And the artist said, well, wait a second. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. So that's what this is about. So in particular, to give you a sense of where I was coming from with this project, I mean, my overall view coming into the project was highly skeptical of moral rights. But my aim was to try and figure out, at least throughout the course of my PhD, and not necessarily in this paper, like what kind of account could we give to support the common accounts of moral rights? What are some reasons we might give to support those theories? And the most robust theory of moral rights, the most robust conception of the theory, comes from France. And the point of this paper is to take that French ideal and see, are there any good reasons why we might believe in that French ideal? Or are there any good reasons for thinking we should adopt it as part of our law? And hopefully it will become clear. The reason for this is that I think the French intuition, if not the French theory, animates pretty much all of the people who support moral rights or think moral rights are a good idea. So even though I'm going to be talking about a highly idealized version of moral rights, I think the intuition and the sentiment are captured by most moral rights scholarship and are indeed the reason why we have moral rights in the first place. One other thing to mention that's important before talking about this is that this question about what kind of account could you give to support the French version, which I haven't told you about yet, is a question prior to the question you will all be considering as I talk, which is, well, how do we balance the interests of the author against the interests of the audience or interest in free expression? And all of those things are important, but they're not really about the thing that I'm talking about today. I'm talking about the prior question, which is, do we have any good reasons to think that as an initial matter, authors should have these moral rights? So hopefully that's clear. And the central issue in French moral rights theory is who decides what constitutes harm. So under the Berne Convention, the right of integrity says the author can object to modifications or mutilations of their work if they are prejudicial to their honor or reputation or something like that. But the key is honor or reputation, and honor or reputation means that it's not just up to the author, right? It has to be that other people think that there's some negative consequence or negative impact on the author. But the French version isn't really concerned with that, as I'll describe in a moment. They're really concerned with the author's feelings alone. So the author gets to decide what uses violate their moral rights and what uses are permissible. So the basic argument I'm going to walk you through goes something like this. First, moral rights have four requirements. So any kind of theory that's going to justify moral rights has to meet these four requirements. One of those, I think all the first three are relatively uncontroversial. The fourth one is where I think there's some controversy, and that's basically the French view, and that the French view is that subjective harm is all that matters. So you might disagree with that, I disagree with that, but I'm trying to just present this argument to you, see if there's anything to it. And then we're gonna ask, given the way I've described the harm, what does that tell us about the conditions under which a moral right might be violated? And what's needed to for the individual to experience that psychological harm that gives rise to moral rights. And then the last question, which I probably won't answer or address too much, is this a desirable approach? I think the answer is going to be no, it's probably not a desirable approach for moral rights theorists, but on the other hand, it may be desirable for people who don't like moral rights. It's sort of an ironic conclusion. And then I'm going to say one final thing just to get some reactions that I don't think has been said before in the literature. Okay. So first I'm going to talk about these four requirements. Then I'm going to try to say, okay, what are some different ways we could satisfy those four requirements? And I'm going to go through four different views. And I'm going to see which one of these views or which combination of these views is the most plausible account of subjective harm that I'm going to lay out. Yep. So first requirement is, I think it underpins every kind of what are called personality theories of moral rights. Personality theory is based on the idea that when I create a work, a book, a painting, whatever it is, part of myself is invested in that work. And as a result, there's this connection between me and the work. And I'm calling that connection relation A. So there's a relation between us that's special, and the specialness arises because I've created it. So this theory, personality theory, is the primary motivating theory for the moral rights that I'm talking about today, the French version. There are other potential theories of moral rights. I'm not really concerned with those. The second requirement requires a little bit of explanation, although I think it's pretty obvious. So I'm concerned with what I'll call the paradigmatic case of where moral rights might persist or exist, meaning if there's any time where there is such a thing as moral rights, where this relation arises between the author and the work, it's going to be in a case where there's one author and one work. I paint painting. I'm not really concerned with what happens if there's multiple authors, or as I'll talk about at the end, what happens if the author uses artificial intelligence to help make a work. And the reason I'm not concerned with those is because they don't really matter to understand whether this theory is plausible. All you have to do is think about the most basic case where it could be true. And I think this is the most basic case where it could be true, where there's a one-to-one relationship between author and work. Okay, so if there's a one-to-one relationship between author and work, that means that the special relation that I get from creating a book or a painting or whatever, that special relation can only exist between the author and the work. And it has to exist, it can be held by only one person, and that person has to be the author, so the person who created the work. The third requirement is also, I think, quite easy to understand. It's that if this relation does exist, and it exists between the author and the work only, that it lasts at least as long as the author's life. What happens after the author's life, we don't know. It's not really important. There's a lot of inconsistencies that arise. If you look at actual law, like the French law gives rights to heirs, which isn't really consistent with some of the things I'm about to say, but it doesn't matter. At a minimum, it's this special relationship's going to last from at least creation until the author's death. Okay, and then the fourth requirement for any kind of moral rights theory is that there has to be some harm. And I would say that most people don't think about harm in the way that I'm going to describe. You know, think that they might conceptualize harm to include honor or reputation. But remember, I'm talking about the French view. And at least as I understand the most orthodox version of the French view, it's not about what others think. It's about what you think as the author. And so this means, I think, and I might be wrong, and I'm happy to learn that I'm wrong, that there are two conditions that harm has to satisfy for a theory of moral rights. One is that it's personal, so that only the person who has the special relation can experience that. And the other is that it's independent, meaning it doesn't depend on what others think. As I just told you, that's a really important part of the French view. So you have to have these two conditions. And so what I'm going to, the first three requirements, I think, are pretty understandable, pretty accepted. This last one is not. And so what I'm going to do now is talk about this harm requirement and present some views about how to make it true that an author could experience personal and independent harm. And I'm going to walk through some cases, some candidates for how we could understand what makes the author special such that they could experience this harm. Okay, so the first view I'm going to present is called the body view. The second view is the view of personal identity. The third is the true beliefs view. And then the last one, which I'm going to foreshadow for you, is the winner, or at least partially the winner, is the memories of creation. And a lot of this paper grows out of work in analytic philosophy on personal identity. And I still don't know if I've gotten it properly worked in. So we'll see. So the first potential way to satisfy the harm requirement is to say, all we have to do to know whether somebody's harmed and violates their moral rights is to identify the body of the person that created the moral rights. So like, if I create a painting and we're wondering 20 years from now, if someone does something with the work, how do we know who has moral rights to that work? We would just point to the body, my body. As long as it's the same body, then, you know, I think we're pretty much good. The problem with this view is that it seems to miss the most important part of harm, which is the subjective experience. So you imagine that Lionel and I decide that we've had enough of our own bodies. We want to try each other's bodies out. And so we undergo this new experimental procedure called a brain transplant, right? And so we go under the anesthesia, and when we wake up, Lionel's brain's in my body and my brain's in Lionel's body. And then we would ask to my painting, suppose somebody wants to throw paint all over my painting. And we say, okay, which of these two people should we privilege? Who's experiencing the harm when the paint is spilled on my painting? And I think if you believe that such an example is possible, even if you don't, you'd want to say that, well, I would, that is to say, my brain and Lionel's body be the one experiencing the harm, right? Not my body with Lionel's brain, because he doesn't have any of the psychological states associated with creating the work. It doesn't even seem like that's the right way to think about it. So I think we can say the body view of moral rights doesn't work. And maybe that's just obvious, but so we can discard that view. So we can't just look to the same person, the same body, and say, okay, that's going to satisfy all of the requirements I laid out before, because it's going to miss the last one, the most important one, and probably all four of them, that the subjective harm component. Okay, so then does anybody know who this guy is? So that's Derek Parfit, a philosopher of personal identity. And interesting side note, he wrote these books about personal identity, and he developed global amnesia. And so he had no memory of who he was. And then he came back. And so it's kind of a weird twist. So, you know, there might be an easy problem to the moral rights question about how do we know whether the person experiences this independent and personal harm. And you might just say, well, all we have to know is that this is the same person, right? So if David today is the same person as the body that's here in 20 years and somebody throws paint on my painting, we can say, well, he's the same person over time. And so he has all of the same psychological states that we would expect him to have. And therefore, we can say he suffers independent and personal harm. I think the issue with this approach was that it may be true that I suffer personal harm, that only I could experience that harm because I'm the same person. But it's not entirely clear why the harm would necessarily be independent. That is to say, wouldn't depend on others' views. It's still possible that the harm that I experience would be relative to my reputation. And so what this suggests is that there's some other psychological feature of my brain that generates some independent harm. There has to be something about what's going on in my brain that makes my harm independent. Okay, so one, started playing too early. One view would be that the thing that's the psychological thing that's needed is my true belief that I created the work. So if I have the true belief that I created the work, that explains why I could experience some both independent and personal harm. It explains why I could, first of all, being a person as the author means that I'll experience the harm in a way that nobody else could. And the fact that I know that I'm the author and that belief is true means that the harm that I experience doesn't have to depend on what other people think. Because remember, if it's just some non-author who believes that they created the work, they might have what they think is an independent reason to believe independent harm, but they don't actually have one. So maybe I can try to give an example of why I think this view might be problematic. So has anybody seen the movie Step Brothers? This is an American movie. Right, with Will Ferrell is. So Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. So Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly are, their parents get married. And they become stepbrothers, but they're both adults. And they're both, you know, obviously have some challenges. So this is a scene from the movie where they both wake up in the middle of the night and start sleepwalking.
Hey, you can't catch me.
I don't know where you learned it, but I'm still sore.
Well, there's lots more.
Okay, so imagine that instead of sleepwalking and destroying the kitchen, Will Ferrell sleepwalks and paints a masterpiece, right? And in the morning, he comes down and says, wow, who did this? And they say, you did. You made this. And suppose he's never created anything before in his life, never painted, never touched a paintbrush. And suppose that maybe they even have it on video. And he can see the video and say, oh, wow, I did create that. And you asked, okay, well, he's got this true belief that he created the work. And he did, in fact, create the work, and he's one and the same person that created the work. Is there something missing from this account? Something that would explain why he may not suffer some kind of independent harm, something that happens internal to him? And I think there is. I think that if you asked him why he experiences whatever emotion he gets when someone decides to destroy that work, for example, you couldn't differentiate his response from what I've said so far from John C. Reilly, who didn't create the work. And I think what's missing is that he has no recollection, he has no memory that he created the work. And it seems to me that if he's going to have some emotional reaction to the work, if he can't remember creating it, literally doesn't remember anything about it, can't even conceive of how he would have done it, it's not clear how he has a relationship to the work in the first place. So that suggests that what's really important for experiencing this personal and independent harm is some kind of memory about creating the work. What matters is that you can remember the emotions or the feelings or the act of creating or something about it that gives rise to this personal and independent harm. Now, we can kind of see this. I'm not going to play this because it's on YouTube, but there's a movie called Total Recall that kind of illustrates why I think this might be important. Illustrates why I think we can say that the memories are one of the key ingredients to this kind of harm. So in Total Recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger goes to a place where you can go on vacation by getting memories put in your brain. And so the rest of the movie is not that important, but instead of a place where they give you some false memories, instead assume we have two people, right? We have Arnold and we have his friend Sharon. And Sharon has just created a beautiful sculpture, but she hates it. And she says, I'd like nothing more than this sculpture to be melted on live TV in front of the world audience. And Arnold says, that's just terrible. This is so beautiful. How could you ever think such a thing? And she says, well, I want you to know how I feel. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to donate my memories to you. So instead of going to this machine and getting fake memories, she says, they're going to take them out of my brain and they're going to put them in your brain. He says, okay, that's fine. So they undergo the memory implantation and they both come out of the procedure, and there's an announcement that the sculpture that Sharon created is going to be melted in front of a live national audience. And suppose that Arnold says, well, that would be terrific. You know, that would be the best thing that ever happened to me. Why? Because I remember how I created this work, and it was such torture, and I hated it, and it was terrible. And Sharon says, why would you do that? It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. If you can imagine that such a case could exist, then I think you'll start to see why I think memories play an important role in generating the kind of negative response that might justify someone saying, I've been harmed. I think the difference between Sharon and Arnold in this example is that when Sharon wakes up from the procedure and she compares the melting of the statue to her own psychological state, she's missing the thing that generates the harm. She's missing whatever negative reaction she would have had with those memories. She's missing that. Well, meanwhile, Arnold, on the other hand, he has those memories. He has those feelings. He has that understanding. And so when he compares the use to his internal psychological state, there's a negative response. So if that's true, that means that all sorts of weird things follow. So that means that if it's true that what distinguishes authors from non-authors is that the author is the same person that created the work and they have these memories of creation, it really limits the scope of moral rights pretty significantly. It means that you'll only have moral rights, if we're talking about practically, if you can remember something about creating the work. Let alone that's workable, you know, how would we figure it out? It just means we forget about all kinds of stuff. I don't even remember what I wrote in my PhD, right? And that was how many years ago? So if I can't remember that, or I can't remember the experience of doing it, then I don't have moral rights. So I think it limits the scope significantly. And I think that's kind of the opposite of what the French view is meant to do. And I think the main point I want to drive home is that this whole thing is so bizarre, that trying to figure out this process is so bizarre that it just suggests that our animating intuition is probably misguided in some way, or maybe the paper is misguided in some way. That's more probable. But I think it suggests that this intuition that the author is the sole determinant, sort of the Blackstonian view of property, but with respect to works, is mistaken. Okay, so that's kind of the paper. And then I want to just raise one final issue, and I don't think this has been raised before, but I have on the screen.
It'll go back on if you press it.
Oh. Okay. So I have on the screen something I was thinking about as I was writing the last portion of the paper. I found these authors who published books and they have like a very loyal fan base. And it turned out that they had just been using AI to generate everything. And so they've forgotten to take out like their instructions to AI or like the AI's responses. And people went crazy and they said, oh my God, I can't believe they're using this. They're not even writing their own books. And I was thinking about it from personality, from the personality tradition. It raises kind of an interesting question that hasn't been raised before. Justin Hughes, who wrote about this a long time ago, tried to say the difference why authors have special moral rights and say plumbers don't is because they're operating within different creative constraints. So you're an engineer, you're there to solve a problem, but the artist isn't there to solve a problem. They're there to, you know, express their whatever. This got me thinking that actually there's something else in the personality tradition that is problematic for moral rights that nobody seems to have grappled with too much. And I try to bring this home with these four scenarios that I have. So in scenario one, you know, you do what we all do and you put your paper into AI, you say, find the typos, find the grammar problems and tell me what they are. And then you fix them. That seems like not to be a significant act of creativity or anything. The second scenario, you ask AI to create an outline for you of a topic. Okay, so you ask it to do a little bit more creative labor. The third, you use AI to write an entire chapter of your book. So now we've edged closer to what is the author actually doing? Let's say you wrote four of the chapters, but AI wrote one. And then the last is the author uses AI to write the entire book. Then you've clearly not done anything. And you just say, write a book about something. Okay, so what's the point of this example? Well, in the first case, it seems like there's no problem. In the last case, there seems like there's a big problem. And in between, it might be a little bit mushy. And the reason it's mushy is because what we're really thinking about is what is the amount and quality, the quantity and qualitative nature of the creative labor required to generate this special relation between the author and the work. So I just raise that as a closing remark to say, I'm not sure that anybody has, maybe I'm wrong, it's been a while since I looked, I'm not sure anybody has articulated this problem within the personality tradition. It's always assumed that the author has this relation by virtue of creation, but there is a question, almost an originality question about how much labor is enough and what kind counts.